From the Latin de Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is Commodity Week. It's our data and technology special with Kepler. This is a company that was formed in 2014 and began by tracking and analyzing cargoes of LNG, liquefied natural gas. They since have expanded and are covering all kinds of dry and bulk commodities, including corn, soybeans, and wheat. In just a bit, we'll talk with the lead agricultural analyst for Kepler.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We're now joined by Ishan Banu. He works with Kepler. It is a large company, I believe, or at least in terms of their scope, and had made some contact asking if we might want to talk with them about agricultural commodities. Ishan is in the United Arab Emirates, located in Dubai. Ishan, thank you for being with us and taking some time. You are a commodities analyst with Kepler. First, can you tell me about Kepler, please?
Sure. Glad to be here, Todd. Kepler is the leading market intelligence provider for the commodities industry. It has its origins in energy, but more recently, it is expanding into dry bulk commodities and all commodities dealing with nature, for example, agricultural commodities. We provide market intelligence solutions for clients. The mainstay of Kepler is its flows. Anyone in the commodities industry can understand where what flows, all the global trade is covered by Kepler.
And what is your background?
Todd, I have been working in the commodities, agricultural commodities industry for the last 12 years. I have worked for trading companies, which trade both physical commodities and futures. So it includes very large grain trading companies around the world, which move millions of tons of grains. I have worked as an intelligence provider on the trading teams, so research. And the main focus of my work is to understand global supply and demand of agricultural commodities.
You said that you followed flow and that this was one of the things that Kepler has done in the industries, all of them that it covers. One of the reasons I was interested in talking with you is that the United Nations is a client of Kepler's, and I take it you're advising them on flow of agricultural goods across the planet?
Yes, that's correct. The WTO is a client of Kepler, and we are advising them on flow of goods.
WTO, of course, stands for the World Trade Organization. So let's start with that. When the Ukraine-Russia war started, and you were watching the flow of goods, what happened to agricultural commodities?
When the Ukraine-Russia war happened, it happened on the back of several other things that were going on in agricultural commodities, especially with production and global stocks. They were not the healthiest at the time. The Ukraine war exacerbated that problem by making it difficult for grain to flow out of the Black Sea. The Black Sea is where the majority of food commodities originate. So we have seen hindrance to flows at times helped by conflict, by active war, and at other times because of political issues such as not extending the grain deal.
So specifically, can you talk a bit about grain flow as it comes from both Ukraine in the Black Sea and Russia in the Black Sea? I would think this would be primarily wheat, but there are some oil seeds and corn as well, feeding into both the Middle East and to China, and what that has looked like and how it compared to previous years. For instance, I am aware that China and Ukraine had infrastructure for grain deal at one point. And I'm sure you have followed all of this. What has that meant to the marketplace?
Sure. So Russia is the largest exporter of wheat in the world. And Ukraine is the third or fourth largest exporter of corn in the world, depending on the year. The world depends, heavily depends on Russia for wheat and wheat prices. Flow of grain out of Russia affects wheat prices very closely and very quickly at times. So when conflict started, there were several issues, including insurance. So, of course, ships would not like to go into an active war zone. But in addition to that, even when things were quieter and trade was allowed, there were issues with insurance and the cost of moving goods out of the Black Sea increased. So far, we have seen that Russia has not had a major reduction in flows. It happened for a couple of months after the conflict began, but overall, Russia has been able to export most of its wheat out, which has, in a way, saved the wheat market by keeping prices at a reasonable level. On the other hand, Ukraine has been devastated, both in terms of production of commodities, of crops, as well as their ability to export grain. Ukraine, in general, used to export between 25 and 30 million tons of corn. And that makes up about 25% of global seaborne trade for corn. This last year, Ukraine exported less, but they still could push out a lot of their corn through the grain deal, which ended in July. However, this year, if we look at what's happening right now, Ukraine produced much less because they could only they could farm much less area because of active conflict. And in addition to that, with the absence of the grain deal, we see fewer vessels coming out of Ukraine right now. And we are in October. October is the harvest month for Ukraine. So this should be one of the highest export months, and we're not seeing that. So about at least 10 million tons of export capacity out of Ukraine has been lost because of the conflict, and most of it is corn.
When you advise the WTO on what grain flow can look like out of Ukraine and Russia both, what are the differences between those two routes? I assume it is the war within Ukraine itself and the Russian Black Sea Fleet, but I'll defer to you and your expertise in this area.
So because of this conflict, Russia has control over the Black Sea, and that's Ukraine's only access to the sea. Therefore, and obviously because of international agreements, non-military vessels are not supposed to be stopped by Turkey in their straits. So despite conflict, Russia technically, according to international law, has unfettered access to the sea and global routes. On the other hand, Russia physically has the ability to blockade Ukrainian ports or vessels calling at Ukrainian ports, and they have so Ukraine needs their permission or an agreement to be able to export grain out. And that is the main reason why we have not seen Russian flows impacted by much. The international community has tried other ways to punish Russia for this, for example, sanctions and setting a price cap for other commodities. However, to a large extent, we don't see these measures working. We see Russia having unfettered access to grain exports. So for the longest time, Ukraine could export its grain through its large ports. Due to a deal brokered by Turkey, it was a tripartite deal between Russia, Ukraine, and Turkey, where Ukrainian grain carrying ships would be allowed to export grain. There was inspection done by Turkey to make sure their grains and to make sure they fall within the quota. It worked slowly, but it did work, and it allowed Ukraine to export its grain. However, in July this year, Russia did not extend that deal, and that was the end of the deal. Since then, some vessels have been calling on Ukraine ports to export grain, and Ukraine has been exporting a lot of grain through routes to Europe, but there are other challenges there. And full-fledged exports of Ukrainian goods is still not on.
One more question is, it's related to Ukraine and Russia, and then we'll start talking more about grain flow, beginning with the Black Sea area. You mentioned sanctions and caps. This would be crude oil, a commodity that your Kipler group follows closely. Have the sanctions worked to restrict Russian crude oil making its way onto the world market?
The sanctions have worked partially. They have not stopped or restricted access to Russian oil for anyone who would want to buy it, but they have made it very expensive. And obviously, if we have seen this in the news, where countries which still continue to trade with Russia are facing diplomatic pressures and other pressures to stop doing that or to reduce it. So the answer would be they have worked partially for energy commodities. They have also reduced the price Russia receives, because they have made it expensive, that they have reduced the price that Russia receives for export of energy commodities, and with ultimately the goal of hitting where it hurts at the bank. The sanctions technically should not apply to food commodities. However, they have had an effect there as well, because payments to Russian parties has become quite difficult. Russia has been excluded from the SWIFT system, and in general, even though it's grain, the amount of paperwork has increased for banks, amount of compliance requirements have increased, and therefore a lot of banks would not help you take grain out of Russia. So it has become difficult.
It is becoming difficult, but not impossible. The grain flow over the last 2 years out of Russia has been comparatively what to historical factors?
Russia has not seen a major decline in exports. In fact, they have not. Wheat exports out of Russia have not been affected by the war. There might have been a temporary pause in exports for a very short while, but that was at the beginning of the conflict. And since then, they have recovered and they have had no issues exporting grain.
Has the size of their internal crops been normal over the past 2 years?
Last year, Russia had its largest crop ever on record, at over 100 million tons. And this year, with the crop that has been harvested since July this year, is going to be 93 million tons, which is still a very large crop for Russian standards. So if you take a slightly longer term, Russia has been increasing its acreage as well as its productivity. So only 5 years ago, Russia would produce less than 70 million tons of wheat, and that number is now 90 million tons. So Russia is a growing producer and the largest exporter of wheat, and continues to become larger.
Is this all acreage-driven, or is it technologically driven as well? Seeds, equipment, those sorts of things?
About 10% is acreage-driven. So the increase in acreage comes roughly at a rate below 10%. But the rest has been crop care and technology-driven. Here, I would like to add that it is also price-driven. High prices help improve crop care and inputs and technology used to produce the crop, and therefore increase yields. Especially you take farmers farther from the port in Russia, where they receive a lower price for their for their wheat. They have less incentive to use inputs on a crop which at the end of the day depends on weather. So as we see higher global prices, you would see higher use of technology and better yields in Russia.
And then the opposite is true in Ukraine of the export of corn. That has gone down dramatically, and I believe the size of that corn crop has also drifted lower.
That's absolutely right. Ukraine has gone down from producing over 40 million tons of corn to around 25 to 27 million tons last year. And all of that is acreage loss. And where acreage has not been lost, the farmers would not employ too many inputs in the crop, which is still uncertain. And there is added uncertainty because of conflict. So that's absolutely true. The opposite is true in Ukraine.
Can you now put the corn and the wheat into context as it's related to global trade of those two commodities, particularly here in the Midwest? We're interested in corn, the price of which has dropped dramatically over the last year, despite the Black Sea area not allowing as much corn out. How do you see world flow and the development of Brazil, for instance, and their corn crop as a major exporting country?
So the price of corn has dropped, and you're absolutely right. It's led by increasing supplies from the southern hemisphere, specifically Brazil. I must say that it has also dropped from a very high level, and that those high levels were caused by the conflict in the Black Sea. And the U.S. also had a lower crop last year, which had added to high prices. The Brazilian safrinha crop, which was harvested in starting May this year, was a bumper crop. And Brazil continues to increase both acreage and yield, especially on its safrinha crop, which is supposed to be a smaller safras crop. Safrinha, the word itself, is for a smaller crop. But that has become the main crop of Brazil because of favorable weather during in the early months of the calendar year. So this is something that Brazil is here to stay for corn. They are increasing acreage and they are increasing yield. Better prices, again, like in the previous example, better prices give more incentive for farmers farther out from port to be able to grow corn and to be able to employ more inputs in the corn production.
Have you done the numbers? Do you know or have an idea of what the lower price of corn in the $4 range per bushel rather than the $5 and $6 range per bushel is likely to do to corn acreage, that second crop or safrinha in Brazil in particular? And I also want to talk about where they export to and whether they filled Ukraine's departure from this marketplace.
So Brazilian farming is extremely profitable, and land holding patterns in Brazil are similar to the U.S. in terms of average land size. And with higher prices in recent years and better efficiency of the Brazilian farmers, they are quite profitable operations these days. So a lower price of corn will have to be matched by a lower price of soybeans and other commodities to reduce the size of Brazilian operations. Sticking to corn, I would say a lower price would a lower price in the $4 range or between $4 and $4.50 would not significantly reduce corn acreage in Brazil. We can say that it might arrest the increase of Brazilian corn acreage year on year, but it is unlikely to reduce it by much. Brazilian farmers also look at relative price between soybeans and corn. So a low corn price would allow more farmers to shift to soybeans and vice versa.
What is your price outlook for corn, soybeans, and wheat at this time?
I'm glad you asked the question. In the industry, we tend to stay away from giving a price level, but we talk about relative pricing. The price level is mainly led by global supplies and global ending stocks. Across commodities, all put together, global supplies are at their recent highs in the last few years. And therefore, I would hazard to say that current prices are in a way justified by higher supplies from especially from the Southern Hemisphere. The outlook will heavily depend on weather. Right now, we are planting soybeans and the first crop of corn in Brazil. We are also planting in Argentina, so we're planting in the Southern Hemisphere. And any weather issues right now in the next from now until January would decide what the production is in South America, and that eventually would help us build a price outlook. So price right now is weather related. However, when it comes to wheat, things are a little different. The soybeans and corn are produced by most of the same countries. It's US, Brazil, and Argentina, the top three. But wheat is different. And unlike corn and soybeans, where global ending stocks are close to their recent highs, wheat is not. Despite a high production out of Russia, overall global wheat supplies remain flat, and ending stocks at major exporters, which we take as a major sign of price direction, ending stocks at the major exporters is at its lowest in the last 5 years. So wheat is not like the others, and we think that wheat prices should distance themselves from corn prices, especially. It also leads to another issue where if the wheat price is too close to the corn price, then in a lot of markets, consumers start feeding wheat, and that further reduces the wheat supplies.
Do you think that a higher price of wheat will stimulate wheat acres across the planet, or more of them, at the expense of corn, soybeans, and other oil seeds, and where might that happen? And it's about the ratio, of course.
The growing regions for wheat are slightly different from corn and soybeans, and also the seasonality of wheat, the growing season of wheat is different. Wheat is a winter crop in most regions, whereas corn and soybeans are summer crops. So in the U.S., in parts of Texas, for example, wheat competes with cotton and at times tobacco for acreage, and not directly with corn. Obviously, in the Mississippi Delta, in parts where soft red winter wheat is grown, it does compete with corn for acres. But in general, if we take the Russian example, or if we take several parts of Europe, there is less of a relationship between wheat and corn acreage, and more so with other commodities. Wheat competes with sunflower, for example, in parts of Europe for acres. A higher price of wheat will definitely allow for larger acreage to come into farming from northern countries where I'm talking here about Canada and Russia. As we know, wheat is a winter crop and it grows in colder regions. So the increase in acreage has to come from up north. And a higher price of wheat over time, we're talking long term here, over time will bring in more acreage in these two countries, especially in Canada and Russia, where more land becomes not arable, but financially it becomes financially profitable to grow wheat in more land over there. But in the short term, my concern is that wheat might be fed in large consuming markets in Europe and in Asia, there is a price relationship between wheat and corn. And if the price of wheat is too low, then it makes sense to include wheat in the feeding ration for animal feeding. And I think we should not be doing that with the current balance sheet of wheat versus the current balance sheet of corn. So if that happens, so a higher wheat price relative to corn would help avoid that and help with the wheat supplies down the line.
Are you of the opinion that the ratio, and it could be a higher price of wheat or a lower price for corn and soybeans, but a price of wheat that does not change, is likely to happen in the next 6 to 8 months?
You're asking me for a price outlook. Yes.
I am. I'm asking you for price direction. It could be a higher price of wheat. It could be a lower price of corn and soybeans. I'm not asking you which. I'm asking you whether the ratio will need to change, is likely to change.
Yes, I think the relative price of the spread between wheat and corn is too low, and we are beginning the growing season for the next year's wheat crop, which is primarily a northern hemisphere crop, and the northern hemisphere is going into winter right now. If we look at weather in the main growing regions, it's drier than usual. It's drier than normal in Russia and in parts of the northern U.S. Therefore, both from a consumption point where wheat should not be fed, and from a short-term outlook on weather and growing conditions, I believe that wheat should outperform corn.
And finally, I'd like to take up grain flow across the planet, because this is one of the things that Kipler specializes in. Again, we're talking with Ishan Banu from Kipler. He's in the United Arab Emirates, based in Dubai. When you look at grain flow over the last decade, and you put Brazil, of course, into that mix, the trade war between China and the United States, how have things changed?
Sure. A lot has changed in the last decade. A decade ago, Russia was not the largest exporter of wheat in the world. A couple of things. I guess we can start from the United States, where wheat has become a less significant crop in the last decade. And they have handed the baton over to Russia. In Brazil and Argentina, we have seen significant, especially in Brazil, we have seen a huge increase in acreage, mainly led by their soybean crop, which mostly was exported to China. So in the last decade, at times now, Brazil has become a bigger exporter of soybeans than the U.S. And recently with the trade war with China, it gave another boost to Brazilian soybean farming, and we have seen the growth in acreage technology being very successful in Brazil, and very large farming corporations in Brazil becoming profitable.
Has China's Belt and Road push changed the way global trade happens for commodities?
That's a very good question. The Belt and Road Initiative is going to change global trade, but it'll happen slowly, and it'll take several years for things to start, and then several more for things to become steady state. However, the biggest impact that we see is connecting Russia's Siberia and Far East, and in general, the northern Asian countries, to China. like we have discussed before, in the marginal areas of Russia, like Siberia and the Far East, price is the only determinant of whether acreage comes under cultivation or not. If you grow something in Siberia and it costs you $200 to bring it to the Black Sea port, then you'd rather not grow anything. And the Belt and Road Initiative over in the future, it'll take time, but in the future, it could unlock profitability in arable land in Russia's Far East. That, I think, is the largest impact from a food commodities point of view.
This is land that's not being used agriculturally at the moment?
It is marginal land, which, yes. You know, like the short answer is yes, it can be used better, and there is a lot of land which is not being used.
Is the infrastructure then railroads and paved roads?
The Belt and Road Initiative, from what I understand, eventually should end up with railroads. That is the idea. Again, it's far in the future, but primarily it will be railroads for the long stretch, for the export route. But obviously, from the Russian side also, a lot more road infrastructure has to be improved for the last mile connectivity or to get the grains to the railhead. It needs improvement.
Will there also be export facilities along the seaboard that they have or are expected to put income into?
It is unlikely. We don't see enough volume for something like that to happen in the next 10 years. I know no one should predict the next 10 years, but we don't see significant volume for East Coast Russian ports to become grain exporting ports or to become major grain exporting ports.
How do you expect Africa to play into the Belt and Road Initiative or into the global trade for commodities?
So I would like to refer to our earlier discussion here. When we talked about the WTO, one of the challenges they were trying to overcome is understanding global food supply from the point of view of food insecurity. With higher inflation and conflict in several parts of the world, food insecurity becomes of concern to the WTO, and therefore they wanted better market intelligence on global food commodities. So when we talk about Africa, Africa is a net importer of staple food, of grains, of rice. It does export certain commodities like sesame and some beans, but overall it's an importer of food commodities. With the Belt and Road Initiative, there could be improvement in infrastructure which reduces the time that ships spend at African ports to load or unload. It could help certain marginal, certain small commodities and farmers of those commodities to reach the market better with better road infrastructure in Africa. But overall, what will help the African consumer is lower prices. And directly, the Belt and Road Initiative is not having much of an effect there.
I'd like to talk a bit more about global food security, Africa's place in this. There is a great deal of investment, it appears to me, from the agricultural industry and from nations, nation states, both along the western side of Africa through Guinea, Ghana, some of those places, and then in South Africa, which already has industrialized some, and of course is an agricultural producer, but other places, Zimbabwe, Zambia, I think Mozambique. Do you see the development of agricultural export, or even just an agricultural industry within Africa that would help feed that nation?
Yes. More and more countries in Africa are placing more emphasis on food security and the need to produce your own food, or at least increase the production. In countries where general stability prevails, there has been a lot of push, again, from the government, from policymakers, to increase the area under cultivation of food crops. There is a lot of marginal land, and there is a lot of arable, unused land in a lot of Africa, especially in Eastern Africa, which can come under food crops over the long term if the market conditions exist, if there is encouragement from policy, and if the cost of production makes sense and the market exists. The rest of the world, we have to realize that the United States has been growing grain forever, and the farming in the rest of the world has become extremely efficient and industrialized. So for African countries to straight away jump into competitive pricing of export food is, in my opinion, a long way in the future. However, countries have a renewed push into meeting their own food demands and are trying to increase the area under cultivation. In fact, I was in Mozambique a few years ago, and I was talking to the government there about processing wheat, processing imported wheat, and they would only want wanted to steer the discussion in the direction of growing wheat and not just processing imported wheat. It was quite interesting.
When you're advising the WTO on the places across the planet that are food insecure at the moment, what are the primary focuses?
So, by nature of how food crops are grown around the world, unfortunately, most of the lower income countries around the world are importers, are net importers of food. And that includes middle-income countries and low-income countries, because it's the tropical curse, you may say. Between the tropics, wheat doesn't grow that well, and that's where most of the lower-income countries exist. So all across North Africa, the Middle East, large parts of Africa, almost all the countries in Africa, and large growing consumer economies of Southeast Asia, all of them come on the map. All of them are importers of food, and in certain countries, food prices or higher food prices could lead to changes in government. So it is extremely important to food security, but also national security in certain countries.
The tropics, for those who are thinking about where that is on the planet, extend across the bulk of Africa. They take in also almost all of Brazil, which now is producing both corn and soybeans. I'm one of the world's largest exporters, actually number one for both corn and soybeans in this last marketing year. Do you suppose that the tropics, because crops have been adapted, row crops have been adapted to them in Africa, other places, will be able to sustain their own food supply?
At the moment, the growth in food supply in countries in Africa is slower than their growth in food demand. So technically, it is possible. Especially with corn. It's less so with wheat, but with corn and row crops, it is possible to increase the land under cultivation of row crops in Africa. Like I said, the cost of production in agriculturally developed countries is quite low. Farming is a very efficient industry. And if it makes sense to, if it's cheaper to import corn than to grow it yourself, then we that is the issue we run into with a lot of countries. You can only make it competitive if you do it at scale and you do it with a lot of technology involved. So it that is the barrier to entry into farming grains.
I would like to come back to Ukraine, Russia, and Brazil at this point. Has Brazil supplanted at this point Ukraine as an exporter of corn into the world market to the point that Ukraine will not be able to regain that marketplace should the war end there? I think this is probably not true because of the difference geographically between the two places, but I'm wondering what your assessment might be.
Yes, Brazil has absolutely supplanted Ukraine in exports of corn. But corn being a feed ingredient is, people are less specific. It's mostly a fungible commodity. And therefore, if once this ends and Ukraine comes back on with its supply, it is price which will decide whether Ukraine is able to export or not. So I believe that once Ukraine comes back online, it will be able to export all of its corn without much of an issue of competition with Brazil. Ukraine also has in the past been a major supplier of grains and oilseeds to China, and I believe that China and Asia in general could be a good destination for Ukrainian exports. Freight obviously comes. I'll start again. Here, the role of freight also is important. The distance, it's simply the distance between Brazil and exporting markets and Ukraine and exporting markets. So if Middle Eastern countries want corn, they would take Ukrainian corn. It's much closer to them.
If you have both Ukraine and Brazil exporting corn into the world market, what impact does it have on U.S. corn exports?
U.S. corn exports would have to compete, obviously, with Brazil and Ukraine. With Ukraine, there was more competition with Ukraine because of the seasonality. Both U.S. and Ukraine corn are harvested at the same time, and the peak export season matches. But in the last decade, almost, we have seen the U.S. to be the storage of grain for the world. The U.S. has the most developed commodities markets, where usually fair carry is present in the market, and even if not present, the physical cost of carry is one of the lowest in the world. Therefore, usually U.S. prices do not compete or compete with world prices only when the rest of the world is kind of running out of corn. So, if this structure of the market doesn't change, then if Brazil and Ukraine both have large crops, then the U.S. will add to its stocks.
Yes, what you're telling me is that corn in the United States will become very much like wheat in the United States, where it already is the storage for the world when it's in dire need, it comes to the U.S.
Yes, but the two crops are quite far in size. So in the U.S., the U.S. is still produces more than 40% of the world's corn, and it is still a very large exporter. It's the second largest exporter of corn in the world. I would not say that the same fate will meet U.S. corn, but we might because it, we are talking about annual crops, and there is always vagaries in weather which will impact production in other countries. So US in fact plays a very important role here by reducing the effect of such supply disruptions in other countries by enabling the market to store grain when more of it is available, and then be able to export more as a supplier of last resort when the rest of the world is running out of corn. So I wouldn't say that corn farming in the U.S. is a dying business, not at all, far from it. But it's the market structure which allows the U.S. to demand a better price at a better time for its corn.
One last topic to take up. What's the impact of the push for biofuels, green fuels, across the planet? And how do you advise the WTO as it's related to food insecurity and other issues?
It's a very interesting balance here, because while food security is important in developed countries, energy security, especially in Europe, energy security is also equally important. The push for biofuels, especially in the U.S., if you look at the EPA's RFS mandates, which started in 2007, have made farming extremely profitable and made it a much bigger industry than it would have been otherwise. So we can say that the long-term impact of the biofuel mandates has actually made farming a bigger business and brought much more land under cultivation. Biofuels are being considered more important by more countries now. We have mandates in Brazil, in Indonesia, and of course in Europe for the longest time. This trend is likely to continue and increase. We see countries micromanaging their biofuel mandates when food prices are high, and because people focus on food rather than fuel when you have to choose one of the two. So the impact on it, in my opinion, has been in the short term an increase in prices, but in the long term, much better, much higher production of grains around the world, and in Europe, much higher production of oilseeds. Which in years of lower supply actually act as a buffer.
Anything else that we didn't discuss that you wanted to today?
So I would like to add that we talked about the biofuel policy. I'd like to add that while such policy like biofuels in the U.S. And in developed countries, such policies are, while they are great for in the long term, these policies tend to have tend to usurp the market in the short term. The global grains market is a very efficient market in all steps. It's very efficient in production. It's very efficient in trade, and it's very efficient in allocating resources to where they're required. Policy intervention usually is not good for the global market. It is usually very good for the country implementing that policy in the short term, but it's overall, in its totality, it's a lose game. It's a win-lose game in the short term, but it's a lose-lose game in the long term. So markets do not really require much intervention, and you know, there is need for intervention at times. Biofuel mandate, for example, anything like that should be done slowly over a longer period of time, so that food and feed crops are not disrupted.
You've been listening to Commodity Week from Illinois Public Media. You may hear the whole of our program anytime you'd like at willag.org, willag.org.
Our guest this week is Ishan Banu. He is with Kepler. It's an organization that advises the United Nations. It's based in the United Arab Emirates. Ishan joined us from Dubai. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.